You can buy a $13,000 telepsych platform, but you don't need to. Today, Peter Yellowlees will tell us how to form meaningful connections with patients through telepsych on a budget. Welcome to the Carlat Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlat Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric nurse practitioner and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Dr. Peter Yellowlees has been doing telepsychiatry since the early days of the internet. That was a time when you had to tell the patient not to move, or their image would get blurry on the screen. A time when patients had to travel to their primary care doctor's office just to get on the video screen with their psychiatrist. He had to sharpen his skills to connect with patients in that low-tech world. He's honed those skills over the years, and today he's going to share them with us. Dr. Yellowlees, how do you start your sessions with patients?
You know, we all use our social skills, not just our clinical skills. And so, you know, when someone comes to see us, we go out and we shake their hand and we smile at them and try and engage them, literally as we take them into our room. If you just go straight on a video and start saying, you know, look, are you depressed? Then that's not very clever. I mean, you actually need to use some social skills there as well. So I always start off every conversation with you know, hey, how are you getting along? What's been happening in your life? Oh, I can see behind you, you've got a really interesting picture there. Can you just take the camera across and show me that picture? I'd like to have a look at that. So you need to engage people. I actually encourage my patients to use phones or iPads rather than computers for a start, so that they're mobile. The phones are perfectly good enough to do a consult with. And so I get them to use their phones or iPads because I want them to pick them up. I want them to walk me around the garden. I want them to introduce me to anyone else in the family that they're comfortable me meeting. I want to see their pets. I potentially want to see what's in their fridge. You know, I want to actually see what the house looks like. How are they looking after themselves? So I can get a whole lot more information about patients by doing home visits on video.
During this coronavirus outbreak, some of my colleagues have complained that they feel like the telepsychiatry sessions are just more superficial than the in-person ones. How do you overcome that?
One of the really important things from a psychiatric point of view is that people are actually prepared frequently to have more intimate conversations on video than they are in person. There is a big literature in the computer science literature that says that if you want to give someone a questionnaire and you want to get an honest answer, you should give it to them to fill in on essentially a fairly anonymous computer rather than have them fill it in on paper in front of somebody, which is what usually happens. And people will be more honest filling in questions on the anonymous computer than they will if there's any human involved.
You spoke of telepsychiatry being more like a home visit. What do you mean by that?
The beauty of this is it gives you the chance of both being in the conversation with the patient and with their family and being part of the sort of family process. But at the same time, you're able to observe much more than perhaps you would in an office, because I literally will say to parents, look, I want you to manage your child. And I tell the parents, you know, I can't manage them from here. Okay, so you've got to be the parent in this session. You've got to manage the child. And so I actually get a better view of parenting skills than perhaps I would if people were seeing me in my own office, where people are inevitably more intimidated, or the children are, or I end up having to control the children myself because the parents can't do it.
One thing about psychotherapy in the office is that it may not translate to the outside world. I've heard about contextual learning, where people learn better and retain it better if they do it in the context that they're supposed to execute it in. How do you use that with these telepsychiatry home visits?
So if you can get to know people, get to know what their homes are like, and then use things in their homes as ways of teaching them how to change their behavior, then it's actually a much more real experience for them. So for instance, I had a patient recently who's had a lot of anxiety and chronic depressive symptoms, and whose cat was dying. And they were taking the cat to literally cat chemotherapy, which, I mean, is apparently not that uncommon. And so I saw this patient, and she always had her cat with her. And we actually went through a grieving process with the cat, which translated immediately to a number of other losses in her life. And then the cat eventually was put to sleep. And I was able to use that dynamically to help her with resolving some of her other losses.
It's been a big adjustment for a lot of us lately, and not all doctors are satisfied with telepsychiatry, but what's it like for patients?
Sorry, so look, the patient experience in telepsychiatry is almost universally good. There have been multiple patient satisfaction studies done, particularly early in the days in terms of telepsychiatry, back around the 2000-2010 era, and they almost always show very high levels of patient satisfaction, higher frequently than actually the patient satisfaction levels you get with in-person care. There are advantages of seeing people on video compared with always having to make someone come and see you in the office.
Are there some patients who like telepsychiatry better?
The children love this, and the younger populations love this. As we know, the average age of a psychiatrist in this country is over 50. So there are big generational differences. With post-traumatic stress disorder, often very hard to engage, and there is some evidence that, in fact, seeing them initially on video makes it easier to engage them in person longer in the longer run. So they can learn to trust the provider on video and then end up going to see them in person or in a hybrid manner. And of course, there's all of the people who've got anxiety and agoraphobia and the people who don't want to come and see a psychiatrist perhaps, but will see them on video, or celebrities who don't want to see a psychiatrist because they may be outed, and who can see people from their home.
I'm just starting with telepsych, but I really agree with Dr. Yellowlees and what he says about children. I have a child who I usually see in the office who's very reserved. She clams up. But when I saw her on telepsych, she was completely different. She was standing there waiting for me to come online. And then she showed me around a room. She was happy to introduce me to all her stuffed animals. And we really engaged. It was quite different from the in-office experience.
Telepsychiatry policies are rapidly changing and vary by state. What's a good resource to keep up with all this?
So the best place to go is to the Telepsychiatry Toolkit at the APA website.
Do you have to use a HIPAA-compliant platform?
Well, my first advice would be to always try and use a HIPAA-compliant platform, because whilst with the 1135 waiver that's currently in place for the COVID emergency, we can use non-HIPAA-compliant platforms, that's going to go away. And I have no doubt that we'll be going back to using fully HIPAA-compliant platforms in future. So right now, for the emergency time, however long that is, and it's in 60-day increments, you can use any video conferencing system. So that means literally you can use FaceTime, you can use Google Hangouts, the free version of Skype, none of which are HIPAA-compliant. I wouldn't advise people to use those. Maybe you use them the first few times just to get yourself used to using video with patients. You know, I would suggest people rapidly move on to a HIPAA-compliant system rather than staying with non-HIPAA-compliant. But you can certainly try out a few patients on FaceTime. And you should be able to get away with just, you know, paying, you know, $50 a month. I mean, they're not expensive, these systems.
There's a rumor that before the virus, you are allowed to use a non-HIPAA-compliant system if the patient signed consent to do that.
That's nonsense. And in fact, it's actually genuinely bad practice, because if there was a break-in, you're not protected anyway. The patient can still sue you.
How do you know if your telepsychiatry platform is HIPAA-compliant?
The person you're buying the system from, they have to give you what's called a BAA, which is a business associates agreement, that they sign, that essentially says that they cannot look at any data running through their video conferencing system.
What are some of the regulations about seeing patients across state lines with telepsychiatry?
Obviously, you know, the official consultation takes place where the patient is, so the doctor has to be licensed in that state, and that's been a big hindrance. There is a telemedicine compact between a number of the states, about half the states now are part of that, so that if you get licensed in one state, it's really easy to get licensed in a second state. But the compact still ensures that you pay the same fees to the second state and have to do the same CME requirements It just makes the process of getting licensed quicker and easier. So a number of people obviously do have licenses in several states. In fact, if you look at the average American physician, the average physician has 1.4 licenses across this whole country. So most people have, you know, more than one license.
So what's your ideal setup for telepsychiatry on a low budget?
You know, the quickest and easiest way, honestly, is just to use your phone. The fact is, we've now got such good technology that we're doing high definition connections here. Most of the good video conferencing systems have apps, and I literally stand the phone up beside the laptop, talk to them on the phone, and type away on the laptop. That's about as simple as you can get. Audio is more important than video. You can do a good consultation with poor video and good audio. You can't do one with good video and poor audio. So we're about 1.5 meg bandwidth at the moment. When I started off doing this, I was doing 128K, which is about 7% of what we're using now. And we used to use two telephone lines for 128K. That was 25 years ago.
In the full interview online, Dr. Yalaliz goes into his favorite platforms for telepsychiatry on a low budget, how to set up the equipment, including lighting and sound, all the medical legal aspects, and the best ways to bill for your work.
You know, Dr. Aiken, there was one burning question that I wanted to ask that you didn't.
What's that?
How does he say g'day? I had a little trouble placing his accent, but I looked him up. Dr. Yalaliz seems to have been raised in England, completed his medical training in Australia, and now lives in California. I can hear a trace of Australian in him, like the way he says can't.
That's interesting that you can hear each of those accents from the continents where he's lived. You know, he struck me as a man who uses whatever tools he has to connect with people, noticing the pendant of the patient's favorite sports team on their wall, asking them to take a walk with their iPad around the garden. He has a real gift for making human connections, and I'll bet his ability to absorb all these accents is part of that.
Dr. Peter Yalaliz is a chief wellness officer and professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. He is also the author of 7 psychiatric textbooks, including the APA textbook on telepsychiatry. And now for a new feature. Every Monday, we plan to end the episode with a psychiatric term from days past and present. And today's word is synesthesia.
Synesthesia, that's Greek for union of the senses. It's when a stimulation in one sensory mode, like auditory music, is experienced in a different sensory mode, as in when that music triggers new visual senses of color. Synesthesia is a rare phenomenon that's recently captured the public imagination through popular books like A Mango-Shaped Space. When more loosely defined as a spectrum, however, it also happens on a mild level in everyday life. Have you ever felt a shiver in your spine when someone scratches their fingernails on the chalkboard? Your mind is converting sound to physical sense, and that's in a way a form of synesthesia. The most common form is called grapheme color synesthesia, which is where people experience colors when they look at letters or numbers. About 1 in 25 people have that form, but they don't all see the same colors with those letters, although there are some constants, like they tend to see A as red. For other forms of synesthesia that are more narrowly defined, the rate varies anywhere from 1 in 25,000 to 1 in 100,000. Synesthesia is common under the influence of psychedelic drugs, where a person might hear and taste flowers that they're really only seeing. Synesthesia is mainly thought of as a neurologic symptom. It's not a psychiatric disorder, and most people who have it experience it as neutral or even pleasant. However, it can be seen in autism and in psychotic disorders, where it's sometimes called reflex hallucinations. For example, one patient described hearing his own shadow. Another felt pain in her head whenever someone coughed. Many famous artists and musicians have had synesthesia, including Duke Ellington, Billy Joel, the visual artists David Hockney and Wassily Kandinsky, and the writer Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote about it in some of his stories.
In the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep, through the desert of the truth, to the rivers of deep.
We'll be back next Monday with another interview, Trazodone and Suicide, with psychiatrist Vaughn McCall.
Wait, we have something coming out before then. Tune in on Wednesdays for our newest feature, 60 Second Psych. Find us at thecarlettereport.com, where you'll receive $30 off your subscription with promo code PODCAST.